Hello and welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I am very happy to have my old friend, Mr. Vincent Ward, back on the podcast. Vincent, welcome back on, buddy.
Hey, Bart. Glad to be here.
Yes. Man, you know, I say there's some times where people were really, you know, friends on the podcast and we, you know, talk on the internet, but you and I actually are good friends, and you're one of the people I always enjoy seeing at drum shows. I come in, and when I see you, it's just kind of that, like I enjoy seeing everyone, but you and I have known each other for years now at this point, and you've been a big help to the podcast. So
thank you.
In general, I appreciate your support over the years with the podcast too.
Yeah, it was nice. I saw you, what, about a week ago, week and a half ago at the Covington show. That was really fun.
The Shields Classic. Yeah, Poe Shies Rogers thing, which was awesome, which there's an episode coming out soon about that with Anthony. So,
Anthony's really great. I love that show, and it's a big draw to going to these shows is being able to see people year after year, and it's really awesome to see what you've built the podcast into. Because the first episode I did was 5, and then I did one around 100 maybe, and now you're coming up on 200, right?
Yeah, over 200. I think actually, if I'm not mistaken with my timing, I think you right now on this episode, I think you're episode 200. Yes. So you did it, buddy. You're there. Because there's been some, like, I release an old one when I'm catching up after the madness of, like, the Neil Peart episode and stuff. So how does that count? But you're episode 200. I will give you that.
Okay.
That
awesome.
Kind of,
nice
you
milestone.
Get that title.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So, all right. But this is a lot of info today. And we'll kind of jump in. And then I have to do a little Patreon thank you. But I want to say up front, what we're doing and what we're talking about today, this is Vincent's idea. He came to me with this, and I think it's awesome. So we're pretty much going to be talking about the process of buying, playing, and collecting vintage Zildjian cymbals, which Zildjian is quite possibly one of the most famous names in the drum industry. Maybe, you know, Ludwig is up there too, but it's like a household name, or at least people know that, like, you know, they might not be able to pronounce it if they're not a drummer, but it's on its 400th year this year, so that's actually pretty, you know, timely that we're doing this. It's something that I know you have a lot of experience with as far as collecting, and so do a lot of people, and there's a whole bunch of different things to cover with it.
Yeah, I mean, Zildjian is definitely, at a certain point, they were the only brand for cymbals. I mean, there were other brands, we'll talk about those, but, you know, 50s, 60s, you know, Zildjian was the brand. It was, I don't think they had that motto, the only serious choice at that point, but that motto actually made a lot of sense, because if you were serious, you didn't play, you know, like Dixie or Krutt, or, you know, you played Zildjians. And if you didn't have Zildjians, you saved and you got Zildjians. And there's another episode with Paul Francis that talks more about the history. This is going to be more about my experience with Zildjian, what I've learned. The history is amazing, you know, having hundreds of years of history. I think maybe Zildjian's just an awesome company. It was the first cymbals that I had. They've been really, really good with advertising, marketing, promoting, and they're, as far as I know, they're still the biggest, even with so much more competition, they're still the biggest cymbal company. They haven't fallen off. You know, they have all kinds of modern artists, modern stuff, new models. We're going to be talking primarily from the inception around the early 1900s with K Zildjians into Avitus Zildjians in late 20s, kind of up through the 90s. And then after that, that's more of the modern era. Yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of falls in the collecting of, like, vintage, because it really, it's weird, but, like, 90s, I guess, I think 25 years and older in the world of, like, cars is considered vintage. So I think that applies to this, too.
Yeah, for drums, people usually consider pre-1980 to be vintage, but Zildjian made a lot of cool stuff in the 80s and in the 90s, too. There's a lot of subtleties to the stuff, the earlier stuff, obviously, that wasn't being as mass-produced. There's more variations and things to find there. For me, I have a strong emphasis on the sound. So you can talk all day about this and that and who played it and what it is and if it's rare or not. But to me, the ultimate test of any cymbal, but, you know, when I'm looking into a Zildjian, I want to hear that cymbal. That's what really because that's a very personal experience too. So
sure.
You could describe a symbol with 15 adjectives and get an idea. You could write the weight of a symbol. This is a 1200 gram, 16 inch symbol, but until you hit that symbol, it's all subjective. So yeah. There's going to be a lot of emphasis in this episode about what was happening at Zildjian during the 20th century. You know, there's still a ton of those symbols. I mean, they made tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of symbols during the 20th century. And a lot of them are still around. So
yeah, just because something's famous and sought after, you may play it and go, oh, I don't like that. Like, you don't have to like it, you know, which Absolutely. Is a watch out. But okay, real quick, huge, I want to give a thank you. So I have a tier on Patreon, $15 a month, where you sign up and you get a shout out on an episode and you get your name at the end of it on all my videos with a little title card. So before we get into it, Vincent, I want to give a thank you to, look over here at my notes, to Gabriel Martinez, who runs GMD Symbols, which is GM Designs is the company, but gmdsymbols.com. He said, let me read a little blurb. Said it's not your typical company. He says he makes everything that the other symbol makers are not. And that's what he's all about. He says he makes more strange, oddball stuff, stuff that has been kind of revised from before and improvised or maybe never been made before. He says he's come out with the first B20 finger symbol, B20 triangle, a multi-bell symbol, and most recently the largest bell ever on a symbol, which is 10 inches. It's a pretty big bell, I tell you what. And he has the standard symbols that he does make are still nothing that are being offered by other companies. So the hammering's different, profiles are different, lathing is different, very cool stuff. So you can check him out online at gmdsymbols.com and see everything that he's got. I looked at it. It'll take you to his Reverb page, and it really is pretty cool stuff, like very cool. So be sure to check that out. And thank you to Gabriel Martinez for signing up. If you guys want to join the Patreon and get a shout out at that upper tier, go to patreon.com/drumhistorypodcast. And it's really cool because this is a symbol episode, and it's cool to have him on this as a symbol episode. So, Vincent, let's jump in here, buddy, and let's start off by talking about maybe before we get into the collecting and the guide, let's hear about your personal history and background with Zildjian cymbals and what started this whole thing for you.
Okay, so I got into vintage drums about 13 years ago, and I've always been fascinated by the minutiae of different things. So I was really fascinated by the variety of Zildjian cymbals that I was seeing, old ones, new ones. So the journey with Zildjian started when I was younger, and then I played some other brands. And when I came back to Zildjian, I was pretty much exclusively looking for the vintage stuff. So I have a small business that does drum restoration, specifically with pedals, hardware, and parts. But as far as studying Zildjian cymbals, trying to learn more about them, that's been something I've been pretty active with for at least the last 4 years, with really the goal to find specific sounds. So I think all drummers have sounds in their head of how they want their cymbals to sound. And during this journey, that sound has, I found it. It took a lot of trying different cymbals, and you know, your ear changes and evolves over time. But especially starting during COVID, because everyone was cooped up and bored, I started really shopping heavy for cymbals and trying to look for things. I would get things, and I still have most of it. A lot of it is a lot of it is in storage, but I have a large amount of cymbals that I need to decide to let go of, you know, duplicates and things like that, and just basically keep the best ones, the ones that I really want to keep for life, and let go of the rest of them. I love A being cymbals. So take, you're looking for a 20 inch cymbal from the 50s. You put two right next to each other, and that's the best way that your ear and mind can process which one you actually like better. Just like when you're at an optometrist, you know, really? Is this better or is this better? You can you can easily tell when you're A being symbols, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think something that is pretty common is that you A B two identical quote unquote identical cymbals, they don't sound the same, especially if they're vintage and they've aged differently. Do you find that that's pretty common, where you may have one that you love and you buy another one on Reverb and they don't sound exactly alike?
Oh yeah, for sure. And the older you get, the more that is the case. Just because you have more of an element of human manufacturing, things were not mass produced. So, you know, most people like a 20-inch ride. I like the bigger cymbals. So 24s, 26s, and 28s, if you can find them. I don't own a 30. They're just really hard to buy. Everyone wants them. I know a guy who has two that just sit on his wall. He has them mounted on the wall. Most of the 30s are from the 60s and later. To find a pre-60s 30-inch is pretty rare and pretty expensive. So that's one that I'm still looking for. I have about 90% of what I'm looking for in my drum room.
That's awesome.
And I feel very fortunate to that to be in that position, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, we live in different... You're in Maryland now, and I'm in Cincinnati, so we've, like, never been to each other's houses. But I will say, from talking, I mean, you've got, like, multiple Camco sets. You've got you've got a ton of pedals. You have a huge collection. So I think people can, like, understand listening to this that, like... And when we go to drum shows and we've shared booths and things, you've, like, taken me under your wing. And, like, I have very much caught on that you really know your stuff. And you have, you know, for a young guy, you've really been experienced and known a lot of this stuff. So people can, I hope, trust what you're saying. But
well, thank you.
That being said, there's a big community about around Zildjians and vintage cymbals in general. Why don't we talk about the predecessors a little bit?
Okay, so most people are familiar with this, but there's a lot of really good resources online. If you type in Zildjian stamps or Zildjian timeline, most people have the same two questions when they have an old Zildjian. Let's say you find a 20-inch Zildjian at a show, you bring it home. Your first questions you're going to ask are, how old is it and what is it worth? The second question is much harder to answer than the first. There are really awesome guides. So I'm going to mention four people here. And they're in no specific order, but they kind of are, because when you're looking into something like this and it's not, it's really complicated, you start by building on the knowledge that other people have already. You don't start from scratch. Sure. That would be really difficult. So Bill Hartrick was, I believe, there had to have been other people that did this before, but Bill Hartrick's the first person that I know of who is referenced by Steve Black. And Steve Black's resource, you can put a link in the description. That's the one people are familiar with. There's another resource by Rob Scott. I use both of them, and as kind of like to double check each other too. So when you're kind of looking for knowledge that's hard to obtain, it's nice to have multiple sources. So Steve Black, he's in New Zealand, I think, and Rob Scott, I'm not sure where he's located. They both have really awesome online resources that are still up. As far as I know, both of those gentlemen are still alive as well. So they have, you could email them if you have questions. And they've just really, you don't have to own a cymbal to learn about it. So you can document, you could just watch eBay and Reverb and document all these cymbals without ever having to own or buy the cymbal. And I think that's what a lot of these guys have done. Or they'll... It's a community effort. It's not one person is the expert. I'm definitely not that expert. And I do want to say that before we get into the timeline, that this is information that I've gathered from other sources, and I'm not here with any bombshell saying anything really a lot different than what they are. The thing that I've done differently is that I have a bunch of these symbols, and I'm comfortable at this point speculating a little bit more than has been speculated previously, filling in the gaps. There is a fourth person, and he's the most important one because I knew him personally and he passed last year. His name is Mike Layton, and I'm going to bring him up probably several times because he's the first guy I walked up to at these shows and asked him questions. And, you know, when you meet someone who has the same special interest like that and you start talking shop, it is the most special magical thing, because they're excited because that someone else cares about what they care about. So I'll mention more about Mike later and how he influence my own personal journey. But I think the first thing we should do is go through the timeline by stamp. And we'll do A. Zildjian and K. Zildjian. And this is what other people have extrapolated based on all the information that they've gathered. And I have a little bit more in there talking basically about the history of Zildjian as these timelines were taking place. Yeah. So we'll start with A. Zildjian. And the first A. Zildjians that I'm aware of are from 1929. That's when the company was established. And they had a good base to build on because K. Zildjian already existed. So K. Zildjian is existing in Turkey simultaneously to Avitus A. Zildjian. And as far as the details of the history and who did what and who was whose brother and who got mad at who, consult the previous Zildjian episode, which is great because, boy, is there a lot of that in this. So yeah. Starting in 1929 in, I believe, Norwell, Massachusetts, somewhere in New England, Avitus Zildjian start being made. And these first ones that are made from 1929 to 39 are referred to as first stamps. If you really want to know when was my Zildjian made, what is the stamp, you can find that information. And sometimes there is some ambiguity. My friend Kelly brought a symbol to the Covington show, and he said it's from the 50s. And I looked at it. I said, no, it's got to be from the 70s. And when you looked at the stamp, it was not really clear. So the stamps are a guideline. You also want to look at the evidence in front of you, the actual symbol, how it was made. And it's good to not be definitive or arrogant about it. I don't ever say anything definitively because that's just not realistic. So at the beginning here, these first stamps, I think it'd be pretty hard to say, oh, they stopped doing first stamps in 37 or 41 or whatever. But you know from previous episodes that we're coming up to a very pivotal time in all United States manufacturing, which is 1942, when you were no longer allowed to use metal. So Zildjian actually weathered that storm really well. And the reason, and one of the things I think that is very unique about Zildjian is still true to this day, is their vault. I have a piece of literature that says, that's probably from the 60s, that says basically that once symbols are done being manufactured, they can sit in the vault for up to 15 years. So that creates a huge window. Starting in 1939, estimated, to 1942, when they were, it's pretty unlikely that they were able to get any bronze. B20 bronze is 80% copper, 20% tin. It's pretty unlikely they were able to get any bronze at all from 1942 to 1946.
Yeah, so because of the war, obviously.
Yeah, all that was needed for the war effort, and it wasn't an optional thing where you couldn't, you know, no one was allowed to, and all the companies had to scramble. The history there is really fascinating. Tons of episodes are going to reference that, and this one is too, because second stamps are very, very similar. Your average person, kind of myself included, is not going to be able to look at a first stamp and a second stamp and tell you, oh, that's second, that's a first. They're pretty similar.
Vincent, can I jump in here and just say that, like, so when you're saying stamp, sometimes I feel like maybe people who are listening to this who maybe don't know, like, you're not referring to where you look at as a Zildjian today and it's like the black logo that's like, it's like printed on it. It's like the on top. These are pressed into the metal. That's what we're referring to as a stamp, where it's,
yep,
it's, you know, actually stamped, not engraved, you know, the word, pressed into the symbol.
It's pressed in. It's a big hydraulic press, probably. And the reason the stamp changes is because you could put a different little thing in there, and that's when the stamps change, is when, but they didn't do it like, all right, it's 1939, time to change to that second stamp. They were just producing items. So at some point, the first stamp wore out and they brought in the second stamp, and that's how, you know, 80 plus years later, we're able to take that information, but everything should be taken with a grain of salt because we know that some symbols sat in the vault for 15 years. So in 1942, yeah. when the L-37 metal rationing came in, they probably had a lot of symbols in their vault. And even though they weren't allowed to produce anymore, let's say that they had a really good end of the 30s and they had thousands of symbols in their vault, they wouldn't have been expected to send those off to be melted down for tanks and bullets and things. They got to sell those. So Zildjian, sure. Zildjian was probably a lot more situated to navigate this period because no one knew how long the war was going to last. Everyone just knew that this was the priority above all manufacturing of non-war effort items.
Yeah.
So second stamp is 1939 to 1942. Go ahead and put a four-year gap in there because metal rationing wasn't lifted until the war was over. It was 1946, probably the middle of 1946. Someone can correct me on that and give me the exact month. But that's when they said, here you go. Now you have access to copper and tin. Because Zildjian is making their own alloy. They're getting shipments of copper, tin. They're saying there's trace elements of silver in there. But they're getting raw metal, and they're melting it down in their little crucibles, and they're making their blanks, and they're making their symbols. There's lots of cool videos on how a symbol is made. And at this point, they've been kind of sitting on their hands for 4 years. They're really ready to make some symbols. And that's 1946 to 1953 is what is referred to as the transitional stamp, trans stamp. And we'll see in a moment that's a bit of a misnomer because these are not rare symbols. They made tens of thousands. You got to think they're all ready to go at this point. The war is over and it's time for them. Their vault is probably empty at this point. Let's say at the beginning of the war, they had thousands of symbols. At the end of the war, they were probably pretty low. Yeah. So what their priority was during this 7 year period was absolutely to make symbols and to make really good symbols too. So transitional stamps or trans stamps are the most highly regarded Avitus symbols, and with good reason. They're thin, the profiles are nice, they just sound amazing. Hand hammering, they hammered it before they lathe it, and they hammered them a lot of times after they lathe it. You can tell the difference pretty easily when there's post-lathing hammering. It just looks a lot different, and you see that a lot on these symbols.
Do you think that was constituted, like, I feel like the generation and the time of the player then? I mean, we're talking 1946 to 53. That's a pretty drum-heavy kind of music. I mean, that's Gene Krupa and those guys where there's a lot of focus on getting the ideas of, you know, what's Papa Joe Jones want. Seems like they're creating some cool stuff just for that reason, you know?
Oh yeah, and there's lots of pictures, too, of the artists visiting the vault and... even though Zildjian had essentially a monopoly on symbol production, definitely within the United States at this point, they didn't rest on their laurels. They were trying to make the best product they possibly could. You have to think also, this company, even though Zildjian has a 400-year history, the history of the A Zildjian company, it starts in 1929, as far as I'm aware. I would be pretty surprised if I saw one that was earlier than that because they didn't have a factory. So
that's good to know. Yeah.
So there is a, you know, history there, but trans stamps, what the key points is, there's a lot of them and they sound really good. At this point, a company that's only been around for 25 years or so has a lot to prove. And I think that there was the type of objective in the factory was certainly to make the best-selling symbols. Whoever was doing quality control at this point definitely didn't let a lot of stuff out that wasn't good. So even though the consistency wasn't there, where you're getting, you know, in later decades, all symbols start to sound alike. You know, you spit out 10, 20-inch symbols, they all sound alike. During the transitional stamp era, that's not true at all. I mean, you could put 10 up and they all sound different. They all might sound good, but good is subjective. Symbols change and they age too. So transitional stamp is a time period where they're making excellent symbols, they're making a lot of symbols, and they're filling their vault back up. In fact, the stamp changes in 1953 to what is referred to as block stamp. I call it block stamp. I use a little bit of my own nomenclature here because sure. it just makes more sense to me. People call them different things. They're called large stamps, hollow blocks. Very easy to tell with this stamp if you know what you're looking for. And they probably just switched to this stamp because the trans stamp ran out. It ran out of juice. It had probably been pressed, you know, thousands and thousands of times. And there's a bit of a flaw that makes it very easy to identify trans stamps in that the pressure is higher on the edges. So the Z and the O and Co is much more indented.
Sure.
That makes it very easy to identify trans stamps. And that's why you can Google that term now. Zildjian trans stamp is going to give you a result of a lot of these symbols because there are a lot of them and they're super easy to identify.
Blue Goose Classic Percussion has provided vintage drum restoration and sales online for over 5 years. They're pleased to announce that they will be opening Atlanta Drum Shop, a full-service drum destination in Atlanta this summer, 2023. Featuring new and used gear by all your favorite brands, Atlanta Drum Shop will be a true drummer support center and cool hang. And if you love Neil Peart and Rush, come play, not just take pictures of their Neil Peart R30 commemorative kit, an exact replica of Neil's kit from the R30 tour by DW. And check out their expansive collection of DW Neil Peart replica snare drums and other memorabilia. As huge Rush fans, their goal is to share these drums with the world. Atlanta Drum Shop is opening to the public this summer, 2023. Join their mailing list to get updates at atlantadrumshop.com or find them on social media at Atlanta Drum Shop. And if you love vintage drums, check out bluegoose.com. That's BLOOGoose.com. And find them on eBay at Blue Goose Classic Percussion, BLOO Goose Classic Percussion. Thanks to Blue Goose / Atlanta Drum Shop for sponsoring this episode. This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at ForksDrumCloset.com.
The reason they change these stamps is not because of like, it's the end of a generation, we're moving on to the next generation. It's like the stamp, the press wears out. We need a new one. Let's design a new one. Okay, maybe we add the dots back to USA or something like that.
Yeah, just like badges, they would have used that as an opportunity to improve. So the one that was going to follow the trans stamp, the press is never going to wear out. The same press probably presses the stamps all the way up until they start doing it with lasers.
Yeah,
because that machine does not wear out. But the actual die that you put in there that is stamping the metal stamp in there definitely changes. And I hope that with this episode that other people step forward and say, well, I actually know a lot more about this, and you could do another episode just on the stamps because we have more considerations to talk about. The stamps are a guideline. So within the trans stamps, you have type 1, type 2, and type 3. And boy, do you have to be pretty deep in the rabbit hole to be able to tell the difference. I still consult the guide. Even owning, you know, a lot of these symbols, and even I can't tell the difference on site between a trans stamp type 1, 2, and 3. I know some people can, but it's actually not super important, especially if you're emphasizing the sound. So for whatever reason, the block stamps only lasted about 2 years, 53 to 55. I would guess this information was largely gathered by talking to people who are original owners. So if someone says, hey, here's my Ludwig kit that I bought with all new Zildjians in 1954, and it's got all block stamps, that's a pretty good piece of information. And then the guy comes forward and says, hey, well, mine's from 1956, and now it doesn't have the block stamp. Again, that's imperfect science because sometimes the symbols are sitting for 15 years, but some of them are also getting made and probably sent right out too, depending on supply and demand.
Sure. No, that makes sense. And again, I'll just jump in with things so people kind of know if they're watching or not watching. and just listening, the block really refers to like it is like as if you're doing like, I don't want to say bubble letters, but it's like, it's as if there's space in, but like Z-I-L-D-J-I-A-N has space in between the lines of each letter. Hopefully that explains it. That's what it is. That's what you're looking for. Yeah.
I would be interested to know why they discontinued the use of this, because based on the trans stamp, we know that a stamp can last, you know, 8 to 10 years, but for some reason, this one only lasted a little longer. And who knows? That information is lost to history. If somebody comes forward and they know that, I would be so thrilled to learn more about these specific transitions. But block stamps are also great, but they're different. The bells are higher profile. The hammering is different. So during this whole process, everything is changing a lot with the manufacturing. Block stamps, I bet, because I'm so obsessed with the sounds, I bet you could put a 22 block and a 22 trans next to each other, and I would be able to easily tell the difference. That's something changed in the manufacturing around the mid-50s. And you got to think at this point, the wounds of the war are starting to heal. They are able to get back in their groove and really start manufacturing cymbals. Drum set playing is growing. And in 56, you start seeing some what I call large stamps or large stamp type one. This is going to get a little confusing. I don't want to get terribly hung up on it, but this is the first time they used a large stamp. This stamp is much bigger than other stamps. Hollow block is also, or block stamp is also a quite large stamp comparative to other ones, but so large stamp just existed for a couple of years. This might have been like a backup die that they had where maybe somebody dropped the block stamp and it fell under a table and they said, okay, bust out the backup stamp. And now we're getting large stamps in the late 50s and, you know, like 56, 57. But at some point they get the new stamp in, and this is the small stamp. And this one existed all throughout the late 50s. So 57 to 60, there's two different types, and they're easy to tell the difference because one is, it could have even been a setting or a way that you stamped the cymbals, because this was somebody's job, was stamping the cymbals, and they probably just sat there and stamped cymbals all day. But when you look at the stamp guide, you could usually tell pretty easily between the A and B.
And it looks like, just so people know, the large stamp, there's a, you know, tape measure, a ruler next to it. It looks like that was about 2 inches top to bottom. And then the small stamp seems to be like less than an inch.
It depends on how you're measuring it. Because there's such good resources online, in my head does not exist the ability to know all those different things. I find it really interesting, but I can identify them enough so that when I'm walking around a show, I pick it up. Oh, this is a small stamp. I'm not thinking,
you don't
it's
have
a type.
Your ruler.
Yeah. Because when you're shopping for cymbals in person, it's really easy. You just hold the cymbal up and you go, you do that one hit, and then you do the edge, maybe you hit the bell, but your ears are what's being trained, not your mind. And it's the type of thing where it's like, the less you think about it, the better result you're probably going to get, because it's not about, oh, trans stamps are amazing, but block stamps, they're not as good, and small stamps, they're not good at all. It's really not like that. It's totally subjective, and different people were making these cymbals. It wasn't Joe Zildjian sitting there making every cymbal. There were guys who were great at making cymbals and guys who probably were not that good. People who were learning and people who got better. Zildjian always had great quality control, so they're never going to send out. It would have been pretty rare, especially around this time period, for them to be sending out anything that wasn't good. But at this point, as the company is evolving and growing, they're getting better. Just like any other company, their goal is to maximize profit, but it's also to make a good product. Cymbals break. If you make a cymbal that doesn't break as often, that people are happy with, then once you send that cymbal out to the distributors, it's not like a nightmare that's going to come back to haunt you, where it's like, well, hey, I got the cymbal, but it's got a manufacturing defect. Zildjian always had amazing quality control, and I would think that they probably still do. So now we're into 1960, and there's another change. So the 60 stamp looks very similar. The way to tell is it has three dots. The small stamp doesn't have three dots in that little, in the Arabic script. The 60s one does. So most people on a basic level, when they pick up a symbol, they can think it either has the dots or it doesn't. And there's some ambiguity to that. But generally speaking, if you pick up a symbol, it's got a small looking stamp and it's got the three dots in it, you probably have a 60 symbol. The lathing gets a little wider. Maybe they're using a different tool. Maybe they're using a different technique. But they're definitely trying to make a more consistent symbol at this point. They don't want all of their symbols to sound different, even though that's really cool. Now they're in a period where they want that consistency, because if you're out on tour and you break your 20-inch symbol and you love that 20-inch symbol and you're heartbroken and you go to the store and you hit another one, it sounds pretty close. That's kind of what they're looking for as a company, is that type of consistency where people can really rely on Zildjian's and know, hey, I'm getting something that is a quality product that is going to last, and the consistency is there. It's what I expect to hear when I hit a cymbal. Yeah. So I have the 60 stamp error going from 60 to 68. I can personally tell from looking at them that they were doing a lot of experimenting during this time period. I've seen 60 cymbals that are made just like 50 cymbals. I'm not exactly sure when they stamped the cymbals. I would think as soon as they passed quality control, they stamped them, because we'll get into this a little bit more later, but they have Zildjian seconds that were never stamped. So if your cymbal is made, you've hammered it, you've lathed it, it's finished, and it doesn't sound good, they're not going to stamp it. But they're
interesting.
But they're also not going to melt it down. Those cymbals became what are known as Zildjian seconds. They either sold them to Manny's in New York, and Manny stamped them with Manny stamp. And almost always, it's cosmetic. So it's not like, oh, it sounds really bad. It's a cosmetic default that says, this is a fine sounding cymbal, but it's not worthy of the Zildjian stamp. So it's possible, I guess, that they didn't stamp them until much later, that they went into the vault and they did sit there, and then later they stamp them. That's kind of hard to determine, but I can tell from looking at a 60s symbol if it was made kind of in the early, middle, or late 60s.
That's interesting. I never would have thought. I thought it would have been a production line of like boom, boom, lathing, you know, hammering, late, whatever it is, rolling, hammering, lathing, whatever you do in those steps. I'm clearly showing that I don't know the full process of how they're made, but then stamping, and then you're done, and then you go from the vault to selling. But I guess it makes sense where if the stamp is on it, it's been through quality control, then you can put it out. Because I guess then it would go to the second line, like you said, Manny's or Zilco or whatever it is. And then I've never thought of that. That's very interesting.
I think quality control has always been a big part of Zildjian. I'm not going to remember this guy's name. His first name is Leon. I can't remember his last name, but this is the guy who was doing quality control in the 80s and the 90s. And did he get good at his job, because his job was taking a rack of 20s and just hitting them. Oh, sounds great. You know, hit another one. Hmm. Sounds great. Hit another one. This doesn't sound quite right. Put this over into a different pile. And everyone knows that when the Beatles were on Sullivan, that everything changed. So now everyone wants cymbals. Well, what does Ringo play? Ringo plays Zildjian. Well, I want Zildjian's. So now all of their hard work and brainstorming and effort to make their production as good as possible, they were again, and you'll see a pattern. Zildjian's a very smart company. The people who are running it and making decisions, all the way down to the people who are operating the machines, It's an extremely efficient process. I don't know of, this is, you know, my opinion, but I don't know of any symbol, any Zildjian symbols where you're going to pick them up and say, oh, that's horrible. You know, it just didn't happen.
I think you're getting more and more modern. The 60s are still, you know, not as modern as 2023, where I've heard people say with drum sets nowadays, you're not going to get a bad one. Like, it might be different, but you're not getting one where it's falling apart. Similar to like cars, you're going to get a pretty good car no matter what you buy. But back in those days, I guess it was getting to more of the consistent, repeatable patterns and processes where you're still going to get pretty good stuff. But yeah, I don't think you're going to pick one up and just go, ugh, terrible. But I do remember with hearing, and everyone has heard this at some point in their, you know, drum history knowledge of when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, it was, you know, 90,000 orders were placed for Zildjian cymbals or something like that. So a lot of pressure to keep up with it, but you don't want quality to fall because then you're in trouble.
Well, also, when you look at these Zildjian videos, how a symbol is made, and they've been making... I have a VHS. I have no way to play it, but I would love to get a VHS player one day and play this because it's from the 90s. And it's the same thing, the Zildjian secret, how Zildjians are made. And it didn't change much. They're not sitting there, okay, how can we make a symbol totally different? They're wanting to make them consistent. And these machines are not something that you want to be messing around with. I mean, these are dangerous machines. You do not want to, you know, step up and lay the symbol if you don't know what you're doing, because it's a rotary tool and it's going to pull the thing out of your hand and you're going to get hurt or you're going to hurt somebody else. So again, you know, you've got this concept of the vault, which still exists. You know, you see these cool videos with all these stacks and stacks of symbols, all these different designations. Back then, there was a lot less designations, but their vault ebbed and flowed. Maybe in the early 60s and in 1963, you know, by the middle of that year, I bet their vault was pretty empty. Because when you have 90,000 orders, you fill all your orders and then you say, okay, well, let's produce some more. At this point, there's no way that symbols are sitting in the vault for 15 years aging. I mean, that just sounds totally not correct. I mean, when they were done, they passed the quality control, they went into their crates, they went to the dealers, and the dealers were anxiously waiting their arrival because you have these kids. I love the episode where Rob Cook talks about when he was waiting for his... you know, for one of his orders to come, and he called the shop like every day and he went there like every day. Hey, is my order ready yet? Hey, is my order ready yet? You know, when that Zildjian crate, when that shipment showed up, you were making a lot of people really happy and everybody was making money. So the 60s were a really awesome era. These symbols sound different. They just sound different than the ones made in the 50s. After 63, they don't have the virtue of sitting there, oh, this one's okay, but it's not great. Let me send it back to hammering. That didn't happen. You don't see post-lathing hammering on 60 symbols. It either passed or it failed. And if it failed, it was a Manny's and it got sent off. They would not stamp them. So you see Zildjians all the time with no stamp. You can look for 3 days and think, oh, maybe it's really faint or maybe whatever.
Wow.
You'll never find a stamp, but you can tell it's a Zildjian. It was a pass-fail type of situation here in quality control because they had, if it really was 90,000 orders sitting there in the books, you know, they had a lot of pressure to fill these orders.
I just got asked then, with the ones that aren't labeled where they were Manny's, and let's say it doesn't have a stamp on it at all, how would you know that it would be Zildjian? Would it just be your keen eye of looking at so many symbols and being able to tell the alloy and all that stuff?
Yeah, you look at the lathing, you look at the hammering, you look at the profile, and... also just the color of the symbol. So a B8 symbol is a different color than a B20 symbol. I mean, you have to guess a little bit, but you can be pretty sure because of how consistent 60 symbols look. That's a concept. The idea of seconds and Manny symbols, those don't exist really before the 60s because everything's changed in the factory at that point. Everything's different. And I'm speculating kind of a lot on this, but I've also spent a long time thinking about it, and I'm just using my own logical extrapolation skills to know what was occurring in the world at these points. You know, everything did change once Ringo was on Ed Sullivan. Everything changed for popular music, you know, and so throughout the 60s, you know, they're making these symbols and they get very consistent and very good. And then in the late 60s, I think their 60 stamp probably ran out again, or somebody kicked it under a table, or because they bring back the large stamp. Remember the large stamp from 56 and 57? Their backup stamp. And again, I'm speculating here. You see that for a little while in the late 60s. And when you see the large stamp, everyone's like, oh, they're 50s, they're 60s. I think they're both. Because you can tell from the stamp's just the first piece of information. After that, you're looking at the qualities of the symbol. So if you see a symbol that looks like it's from the 50s and has a large stamp, it probably is from the 50s. If you see one that looks more like a 60s, it's probably from the 60s. It's not perfect information. You are guessing. But those large stamp type twos from the late 60s, they sound great because at some point they finished that last 90,000th order and they were like, we are caught up, let's start filling the vault up again. And those symbols sound great to me. They sound better than 60 stamps, but that's my personal opinion. So Zildjian survived all that period. They survived the war, they survived the 50s where they're learning kind of how to make really great symbols, they survived the 60s where they're 90,000 orders backlogged, And now they're into the 70s, and you get a brand new stamp, the 70 stamp. It's pretty easy to tell. It's everything. The lines are thinner. It does not have the three dots. So if you look at a symbol and the stamp looks smallish, but it doesn't have the three dots, it's probably either 50s small stamp or 70s thin stamp, whatever you want to call it. The exact words are not important. And all of the wording has kind of already been set in stone by these guys who did all the research 20 plus years ago.
And you're referring, just so people know, you're referring to not the dots that are in the USA and the made in USA at the bottom, but you're referring to no having no three dots up in the Ottoman engraving up top, which says company, Avidus, Zildjian in their different Ottoman Turkish language, as I'm seeing here on black.net.nz. So
that's also what's cool about this Zildjian journey is there is so much information. There's no way one person could really know all of it. That's why it's awesome to have these reference materials. And we went through the period where there's a lot changing. Now we're in the 70s. So from 70 to 77, you've got your 70s stamp. Now there was ink stamps on these symbols. There's ink stamps going all the way back to first stamps. You know, at some point they had little ink stamps and ink blotters that they would put the stamps on, but a lot of them didn't get that. The way symbols were ordered at the time, if you wanted an extra thin 16-inch symbol, that would have been something that was maybe they didn't have so many of. And when they were done, they would have stamped it just to say, hey, look, we made this symbol and it's an extra thin. Mostly it's the weight designation. You also see ones that say like other things on them. You know, they had a little set of ink stamps at Zildjian during this whole period that we've been describing. But in the 70s, especially in the late 70s, ones that are in the mid 70s, that's when you start seeing that really iconic block lettering that says medium ride, earth ride. You know, something changed during that time period where they said, okay, now the models that we offer are going to be different and they're going to be designated. So when you go to the store and you're shopping and you see three 20-inch Zildjians, say, okay, here's a medium. Here's another medium. Oh, this one's a rock ride, and it's heavier, it's pingier. Well, I like that rock one. Now that becomes part of the process is putting these symbol designations. That starts taking place more so in the mid-70s, I would guess. By 78, that's when you get the first Zildjian ink stamp, and they call it hollow ink because it's not filled in. So it's the Zildjian with a thin outline. Those are great symbols. I mean, they're really wonderful symbols. That exists from 78 to 82. In 82, at some point, the Zildjian becomes solid, and pretty much all of these symbols, I would think, it was part of their process to designate that this is a medium ride, this is a medium thin crash, medium crash. And these change throughout that time period. There's a lot of good literature. There's stuff on Drum Archive. But during this period, you start to see the ink designations from 82 to 92. The process is pretty streamlined.
Well, I mean, I would say at 82 to 92, if I'm not mistaken, 81, Bob Zildjian leaves. 83, he's allowed to take on the American market or something like that. In that range is when Sabian comes into the world. So that's like, you know, lighten a fire a little bit there. There's some, not that Meinl wasn't competition, not that Paiste wasn't competition with all of their, you know, kind of things, but now this is, you know, Sabian's in Canada, but it's a lot closer to home. And I mean, literally it's the family. So there's a different dynamic going on.
So seeing how they interacted and thinking about the reasons why these changes might have been made is really interesting. They have more competition now. Paiste comes in strong in the 70s, and a lot of people like that sound. It was just so different. And, Zildjian was always a company that was going to continue trying to improve and make better products. But, you know, lighting the fire is a good analogy because they did lose some serious market share. If in the 60s they had, 90%+ of the market share. Now it's lower. Maybe they're at 75 or 80% of market share. And there's the people that are in there hammering and lathing and making the symbols and the people who are deciding what's a rock ride and what's a medium ride. And then there's the people who, the suits, the guys who are sitting behind the desks and thinking, okay, we're getting killed by Paiste. How can we compete with them. And all that's happening simultaneously. And in the early 90s, so there's symbols that were made in the 90s that don't have a serial number on them. Just from probably 92 to 94, this is by this point, A Customs exist, Z's exist. There's different designations. If you look at your stamp and underneath there's no serial number, then it was made before 1994. The last era of stamp is 94 through present, and those were all done by lasers. So they look different because they start using a laser to do the... So if you have a serial number, you can easily date your symbol. You can look at there's two letters, and based on what those two letters are, you can say this was a symbol that was manufactured in 97 or 2002. Wow. And that's a really cool system. It would have been awesome if they did that right at the beginning, which never, never would have happened. But during the 90s and onward, there's no more ambiguity. I have a symbol, and there's guides for this. 90s Zildjians are just super cool. I mean, seeing A Customs, how they're developed, seeing Z, which turned into Z Custom.
For sure.
You've got EFX symbols, EFX Piggyback. They're doing different things. They're still getting artists. Artist input to make these decisions, but that's the run of stamps for A Zildjian. So that took a lot longer than I expected with the A Zildjian stamps, because we were talking so much about the factory and the things that were going on during the time period.
It's interesting, and I am looking at your outline here though, there's A and there's K as well. So that seems like a little bit less information.
Oh no, it's much more, and it is so. I'm going to speed run through the K stamps because I know a guy who can do a K stamp episode and he knows 100 times more than me, and he actually owns all the symbols. So I only own a handful of old Ks. They're expensive. I miss the boat. You know, I do have some old Ks. I love them. But that's a totally different sure. episode. I'm going to speed run real quick through the K Zildjian stamps. So K Zildjian starts before A Zildjian. So you have symbols being made in 1907 through 1929. They say Constantinople, and that's, you know, literally the name of the country changed. So it says Constantinople, you know that it's during this time period. And the subsets for these K stamps are, I don't know them. I mean, there's guys who could say this is a old stamp type 2C. And that means something. The stamp changed a lot. And in Turkey, the stamps were not being done with a hydraulic press. They were definitely somebody holding a stamp and somebody else hitting a hammer onto it. So,
sure.
So there's a lot more variation between them. And most people think that old Ks are the best symbols ever made. And I wouldn't disagree. I mean, there's a lot of variation. They don't all sound good. A lot of them are cracked. But generally speaking, if you put your stick on an old K, you're going to hear something pretty magical. With the old stamps, it's even more so. So 29 to 59, that's a 30-year period. Those are all old stamps. And that's why there's so many designations. These same guys have also tried to figure out the K stamps. But in 59, and remember, these companies are operating independently. There's no collusion between A Zildjian and K Zildjian at this point. They are competitors. Even though they're both using the name. So in 59, they changed to intermediate stamps. So if you look back to Zildjian, you know, during this time, Zildjian's in the small stamp era, they're about to hit the 60s and they're ready to rock. K Zildjian was probably following a very similar timeline. So 59 to 66 is intermediate stamp. And in 67 to 77, which is when the Turkish K Zildjian factory folded, that last decade are new stamps. And those sound a lot different. An old stamp and a new stamp are clearly different by sound, by visual. Yeah. Old stamps are more made by hand. They were using a sledgehammer to press the bells in shape. Totally different process, Turkish made versus American made. Totally different things, but that's the speed run. If you want to know more about K Zildjians, I'm going to recommend a guy who can talk more about that more intelligently and definitively. And but just to know that those companies are operating simultaneously, but following the same trends. You know, K Zildjian got an influx of orders in the 60s too. You know,
yeah, sure. And I mean, just to give my outside. I mean, I'm a drummer who loves Zildjian, but my outsider perspective. if you have a K, they do not, like the early ones, they do not look similar stamp wise at all. It's very clearly, I mean, like it says Istanbul or Constantinople, they're very different stamps, which if you have such a special and nice symbol, you probably kind of know what you're looking for a little bit more just because you have such a special symbol. But look at these guides that are in the description, but they are not, it's not something where you'll look at it and go, you know, oh, I'm not sure which one it is. It's pretty clear that these are hammered with, you know, a little like, you know, stamp in their hand. It's obvious that these are a different kind of stamp.
Yeah, a totally different thing. And I know people who love K's and A's. I know people who just love K's, just love A's. So the next thing that I want to talk about is buying considerations. So we've just went through the history of this and we were pretty thorough with it. I tried not to have any overlap of knowledge that's either super commonly known or is in the guides or has been covered in other episodes. But so that's my timeline of A Zildjian and briefly of K Zildjian. But the part that I think is really interesting is the buying consideration. So now you know all this and you're interested and you want to play old Zildjians. So what do you consider when you're out here shopping for these symbols? So I have these things in order of importance. So the number one is always sound. So you're buying symbols online, you expect to hear a sound file. If you're buying a symbol without a sound file, you either really know what you're doing or you've just made a horrible mistake, because it's such a subjective thing and symbols don't all survive either. So if you've ever heard a symbol that just sounds totally dead and dry, that's because it was probably in a fire. You see them all the time. It's almost like surreal to hit it. It just doesn't even sound like a symbol. There's just nothing left there. Something about the heat being in a fire. You know, so it might look like the greatest symbol ever, and you hit it, and you're just super disappointed.
Yeah, something's wrong. Yeah.
So I actually, a couple of years ago, maybe like a year ago, I just stopped shopping for symbols online. I had gotten a lot of the stuff that I wanted, and I really got fed up with buying symbols online. And the main reason is that you can't possibly know how they're going to sound. Even hearing a sound file, it's in someone else's room. It might be processed. You have no idea. So personally, where I'm at in my own symbol journey, and because there's not a ton of stuff left that I'm looking for, I just buy symbols in person. I'll go to a drum shop and hit a symbol, and I'll you know, be able to have a lot better information there and be much more likely to be happy with my purchase, or I'll go to a drum show, even if there's 100 other people hitting cymbals. I've trained my ear to the point that I can hold up a cymbal on the one finger and hit it, you know, hit it with a stick and know pretty much in one hit whether or not it's a cymbal that appeals to my ear. So
Yeah,
that's not the kind of thing that's easy to teach or explain. You have to just hit a lot of cymbals and you have to be committed to the quest of finding the symbols, because it's not like you're buying a 20-inch A custom ride where you can literally hit 10 of them and they all sound great. Maybe they're slightly different weights. The second consideration is gram weight. People usually give the weights in grams, and that can start to really mean something. So I know, because I've shopped for 24s for so long, that a 24-inch cymbal that weighs 3,000 grams is going to sound pretty good, and one that weighs 4,000 grams, I'm not interested in it whatsoever. Anything less than 3,000, now we're in an interesting territory, because that's really light. And that might be where you could make a pretty speculative decision if someone said, I've got a 24-inch cymbal and it's 2,700 grams. Well, that's a really light cymbal. And like for a 22, something that's the same weight range would be like anything that's around 2,000 grams or slightly less. That's the kind of thing you can only really start to incorporate into your buying when you've just heard a lot of cymbals. But you can absolutely shop online. You know, definitely listen to sound files. But
sure, that's a good way to look at it. Use the sound files to gain your knowledge and education, and then try, if you can, to go into a store or drum shop knowing what you've learned through the sound files. Makes sense.
Sure. And I have the third consideration here as condition. So really look for cracks. And that's why, in a sense, and really listen for cracks too. If you're buying a cymbal and you're in a loud drum room, absolutely hit it and hold it right up to your ear and see if you hear a rattle. Because if a cymbal was cracked, that's really bad. I mean, it's you can repair cracks, and there's lots of cracked cymbals that sound great. But once a cymbal is cracked, it's a different type of thing. It kills the value, and B, it's only going to continue cracking. So you really have to factor that in. I have as the fourth consideration source. Is the source trusted or the untrusted? So a drum shop that's been around for 20 years, or even a lot of these younger guys who have their own drum shops that are specifically vintage focused, a lot of them have a really good reputation. So if they sell you something and there was no damage disclosed and you get it and it's damaged, they're going to take care of you. Some of them. Some of them are going to say, you know, well, you're SOL because you bought the cymbal and it sold as is. And, you know, I didn't see the crack. You didn't see the crack. The transaction's over, and you're gonna have a really hard time getting your money back. But that's like the type of thing that's only gonna happen once. If that's happened to you, you're probably never gonna buy from that source again. So you either trust your source or you don't. And if you're buying from Joe Schmo on Facebook and they're saying, hey, I got a 22-inch Zildjian, you know, it's 1700 grams, it's an old K, old stamp, type 2B, or whatever. Well, do we trust this person or do we not trust it? We can trust the drum shops because their reputation is on the line and they wouldn't exist if they kept screwing people over. But can we trust this random person on Facebook? Maybe, maybe not. So consider the source of your cymbals. It takes the reason that drum shops are going to charge you a little more for your cymbals is because they're doing the due diligence for you. You know, take your fingernail like this and run it all the way along the edge of a cymbal. And how many times does it catch on something? Are they cracks? Are they flea bites? Are they big dings where a piece of the cymbal is missing? All those affect the value of the cymbal, but also, so we're all the way down to number five before I'm even considering the price. That's a That's a really big consideration. So once you've factored in all of those other considerations, now what is the price? So it's a 20-inch trans stamp and they want $750 for it. Well, that's a lot of money. The condition better be pretty much perfect. You know, you go backwards. Well, does it sound really good? Is the weight really light? Is it from a trusted source and it's in perfect condition? Well, now maybe $750 is actually a great deal for this cymbal. I've seen 20-inch cymbals that are like 1,200 to 1,300 grams. I mean, they shouldn't even exist. It's almost like it was a contest at the factory to see who could lathe the most off.
Yeah.
But they exist. And
jeez. Yeah, cool.
As the years go on, less of them exist because they break. You know, a thin cymbal is going to break. So thinking about the price versus the other considerations, that's where you get your value consideration. Well, what kind of value am I getting here? If you have a 20-inch trans stamp and the guy wants $50, go ahead and pull $50 out and buy it. You know, check to make sure it's not cracked and go ahead and pay your $50, because it doesn't matter if it's the worst dog ever. You got such a good deal.
Yeah, someone wants it.
Exactly. And I have had deals like that too, where, you know, you hit a 22-inch trans stamp and you ask the person how much and they say $100 or $200 and you don't have to think about it anymore because so all these factors weigh into your decision. This is kind of going back to the source, but, you know, you thought about the condition, the weight, how it sounds, the value. You've thought about the source. Is this a symbol you're going to be able to return? So if you buy something from someone in a parking lot and you don't even know their name, you know, you're just meeting up with them on Facebook and then you go back and they've deleted their Facebook. Well, that's going to be a no returns situation. Yeah. It's your symbol now. But if you bought from a reputable shop and you don't like it, well, maybe they'll give you your money back or give you a store credit and then you can continue shopping for symbols.
Sure. And that there may be a little bit of like you buy a symbol on Facebook and you just don't like it after a week and you want to return it. That's nothing wrong with the symbol. That's not how the world works where, you know, again, you didn't do anything wrong. You can also not do returns and it's not a bad thing. It's just that you didn't check it or something.
A lot of these shops that deal primarily in vintage, they just have an as is policy. You can't return it because it's a slippery slope where you say, oh, well, if you just didn't like it, maybe it's same with drums. You get it and it's a little less green than I thought it was going to be. Well, I'm really sorry, but as the buyer, there's a phrase called caveat emptor, and it means buyer beware, or basically means do your own due diligence. That is pretty important with symbols.
Yeah.
If you buy a symbol and it doesn't say anything about the condition, that's a red flag. Because very few symbols, especially as they get older, are in perfect condition. It's kind of up to you to ask the right questions. And that's why, again, a reputable drum shop is going to tell you, hey, this doesn't have any cracks, any keyholes, any flea bites or edge damage, no warping. That's great. If they say all those things, then you're covered. Because if you get it and it's warped and cracked, well, now it's item not as described, and you can easily get your money back from however you paid. Two more just quick considerations that are lower in the list is rarity. So I said I'm looking for a 30-inch pre-60s Zildjian symbol. I've only ever seen two. So when one comes up, I better factor in that rarity, because regardless of what the price is, regardless of what the condition is, and almost regardless of how it sounds, I might never see one again. If there's only two and the people who have them aren't going to come up off them, then, you know, that's a pretty strong factor. And that's why I put the last one as FOMO, which means fear of missing out. If you've been looking for a 30-inch symbol or a 28-inch symbol for 5 years and one finally comes up, you better have that money ready, and you better be ready to compete with a lot of other people who are also maybe looking for the exact same thing.
Sure. It's like the it's worth what someone will pay for it kind of old saying, where if you really want it, then you can pay a little more for it. And just all of this, before we move on to the next section, just makes me think that, like, learning these things, having this knowledge, makes going to drum shops and drum shows even more fun, because you can look at this. Someone might look at a rack of old cymbals and say, I'm not looking for a cymbal. But if you know what you're looking for, you can do the hunt and, like, flip it over and look at the stamp and look for the three dots and look for, is it a K? Is it this? And then you get another level of, like, of fun, of enjoyment from your search, which is just a super cool thing to have the ability to do.
It's a cool level of immersion too, because the ability to get a good deal lessens so if you were going in to my buddy Joe's shop, Wooden Weather, you're not going to go in there and find something where you know more about it than he does, because he just knows so much about it. So he's coming in, you say, hey Joe, what is this? He's not going to be like, oh, I don't know, it's an old symbol, give me $100. He's going to be like, well, it's an 18-inch old K, and it's light, and it sounds great. The price is $1,300. And you know, as a dealer and someone who really has their finger on the pulse with that stuff and goes through hundreds of symbols per year, it helps you shop a little bit. But it's different than going into like an antique mall and finding that same 18-inch old K, and the price is maybe $200, but that's still an amazing deal.
Sure.
The shopping part of it is definitely very fun. The more educated you are, the more likely you are to be able to find what you're looking for. Because some of it is, you know, we went through 9 different factors to consider when you're looking for a symbol. You don't have to factor in all 9 of those. You could just do that first one. Hey, I hit this symbol and I like it. There's some people in this world who are independently wealthy where the price is no object to them. They hit a symbol and they like it. Hey, how much does it cost? Oh, well, it's $700. You know, here you go, $700. Yeah. The prices, I know plenty of people like that, where the price is not an object. The sound is, they just factor in that first one. And maybe the condition, the source, maybe they're not worried about returning it because they just hit it and they know that they love it. And it's exactly what they've been looking for years.
Yeah. You know, buying to sell. They just want to play it and that's what they like. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, life is short. So, you know, when I die and they figure out what to do with my piles of symbols, somebody's gonna have a really fun time looking at what I collected, what I kept, and why, and then figuring out what it's worth and how to sell it. I mean, good luck to them, because the majority of the stuff I have, I'm not ever selling it. I mean, because I went through this journey, it took me years and years and years. I've invested so much time, energy, and money into it that the thought of selling it never enters my mind. I mean, why would I? If you looked for something for 3 years and barely got it and you had to pay full retail, or some of the stuff I paid more than full retail, I would never even consider selling it because I'll never get it again. And the value fluctuates too. So there's 9 factors here that you can put into play when you're considering, but you do not have to consider all of them. They're going to be weighted in a certain way based on your own objectives, goals, and resources. And if you like the sound of something, that's by far the most important factor.
Yes, which on our outline here, looking, you kind of zero in a little bit more on factor one, which is sound, which just to kind of read a little what you have, I think you've worded this very well. What constitutes a bad, good, or great sound is subjective. Descriptive or flowery adjectives can be helpful, but a sound slash video file gives you a much better idea. And as you said before, playing the thing yourself is really important. And as you've stated on your outline, the room you play it in changes. And it might sound okay. And, you know, if you're in Guitar Center or a drum shop or whatever, you get home and the thing doesn't sound anything near what you thought it was. I remember as a kid buying my first like ZBT Crash, and at Guitar Center, I was like on a DW kit and I'm like, this is amazing. And I get home and I'm like, okay, this doesn't sound nearly as good as I thought. But comparatively, you just got to, you know, keep it all into perspective and find what's right for you.
And it changes, too. The symbol that I would have loved 10 years ago is not the symbol I love today. That's why it's cool to have variety, different sets. And yeah, absolutely. There's nothing. It's a journey. It's an imperfect science. So you bring the symbol home from the Chicago Drum Show and you feel like you've really factored in. Let's say you're a diligent person in a really, you know, a really smart shopper, and you feel like you factored in all nine factors and you feel like you got a great deal. You check the condition. It's no condition issues. You get it home and you hit it. But boy, it sounds just as great as I thought at the show. And then you put it up with you bought a 20 and you put it up with your 18 and your 16 and you hit them together. And the 20 just doesn't sound right. you know, it sounds great on its own. I went through this with 24s. I had a 24 and I hit it. Man, I love that. Put it up with another 24. Doesn't work. And going through the process. So you can be as specific or picky or not as you would like to in this process. And the cool thing is, unlike shopping for a modern symbol, there's so much variation between the two that there is no right or wrong. You can, so I have a quote here from my friend Casey Smith, and he is awesome. He is a really great player. He's one of the Vitalizer artists who plays Vitalizer pedals, and he's got a hi-hat stand. And I really love sending him stuff for free because he gives me feedback and then he tags me. And it's not just like someone who's has their hand out for something for free. He really is on the same level with this stuff. And I know he's been on a journey to find symbols for a long time. He ended up really loving trans stamps. And I asked him for this episode, Casey, what do you look for when you're shopping for an old symbol? And I'm just going to read this verbatim because I think he said it perfectly. He said, a balance of stick wash and highs, lows. It's the marriage of the highs and lows that gets me. The 50 Zildjians are a full spectrum of sounds, but with a softness that is also hard to find. I feel like modern dark symbols get lost unless they have more weight to them. Modern bright symbols seem to lack the fullness of lows and just cut through everything. Vintage stuff has the perfect blend that allows you to be heard, but fills the right amount of space. That's really beautiful, Casey, because, and also it just shows that you are pretty far on this journey. I know that he just bought a 20 inch trans stamp and he's had like five or six other ones. That language just shows such a level of sophistication. And when you watch his Instagram videos and you listen to his cymbals, you know, the ability to, the overtones, the undertones, is it high? Is it low? Does it blend? When you hear him hit the 18 and the 20 together and the difference between them and the separation of the bell, you can tell that this is a person who's really serious about their cymbal sounds. Not only he's tried modern cymbals, he's tried Turkish cymbals. I know he owns lots of different things. He owns things that are made by different makers, but he has in the process that we've described, he has gone really far to the point where the sound that he hears in his head, what he wants a cymbal to sound like, is the sound that he hits every time he sits down to play. And
true,
it was not an easy thing to accomplish. And to be able to articulate it that well, I'm really glad that he was fine with me sharing this quote, because I think it really epitomizes everything we've discussed so far. When you put in the work, this is the payoff. You can end up with a cymbal sound that's not only completely unique to you, but this is, you know, when I was 18 years old and I started wanting a different sounding ride cymbal. I had a 21 inch A custom projection ride and it sounded great. You could crash on it. And I started hearing these other rides, these old Ks and different Ks and stuff, K custom. I thought, you know, wow, these are really expensive, but I want my ride to sound different. And I remember just trying all these different cymbals, going to a drum shop, hit every single one. You know, you buy something, you get it, and it's not quite right. It's too dry. It's too thin. But you don't know until you know.
Yeah.
Being a very prudent shopper and someone who dedicated themselves to this journey of figuring out the sounds, the payoff is when you get to where you want to be, you know.
Totally. Yeah. Very well said. And I will say, looking him up, Casey Schmidt's Instagram handle is C Schmidt. So CSCHMIDTYS on Instagram. Look him up and check him out. Because that was very well said. And like you said, that's the end of the rainbow, is like having that, like, it's like, it sounds like almost like wine or something, where to me, I'm like, I will drink a $10 bottle of wine and be happy. I'm more of a beer guy, but it's like, but the people who really, really enjoy it can tell the notes and everything in it. And I think cymbals are a lot like that as well.
Look at Eric Binder too.
Yes.
Eric Binder is an amazing player, and he has lots and lots of old Ks and old A's. And he's a person who's a lot further on this journey than I am. I got really lucky to have the stuff that I have. I also paid a lot of money for it and looked for years and years and years. But you can be the person who ends up with a great set of 60 cymbals that you really love, or you can be the guy who really wants a set of old stamp Ks and wants to do a full set. My buddy Bob Meyer, he lives in New Jersey, and he's in his 70s. I don't know exactly how old he is, but he's in his mid to late 70s, but very young at heart. And he has all his sets of old Ks and old A's, and he's had them forever. And he completed this journey in the 90s. So if you're starting this journey today, talk to someone like Bob, talk to someone like Eric, ask questions, shop. It pays to look at the details. But yeah, you can go as far. That's what's cool about it too. You can go as far down the rabbit hole as you want, or you can just stay near the entrance of the rabbit hole. And get some cool, nice, consistent 60s sets. It's really about what sounds right to you, what feels right to you.
And about having fun, and just, it's supposed to be fun and enjoyable. And, you know, if you're like struggling to feed your kids with money, then don't go out and buy some $1,200 cymbal or something like that, which we're all tempted to do. But looking at the next one, considering a source, I feel like because of time, and we're trying to not have this be a 2.5 hour episode, I think you did a good job of explaining it, but I really like how you have issues to be mindful of. Can we hit on that a little bit, or is there anything in there that you want to make sure you hit?
Yeah, I think during the first section where we talked about the source, I think that's good enough for now.
Yeah.
But I will speed run the issues to be mindful of. So trusted source versus untrusted source. There could be a lot of reasons why someone might sell you something that's not what they said it was. And it's not always deception. So really considering your source to me is a very important one. I have certain people, certain shops that I would never buy a cymbal from them, even if the price was right and even if I loved it, just because I believe in speaking with your wallet. I think that if you really do not trust a source, even if they're a source that has a lot of inventory coming through their hands, if you don't trust the source, then speak with your wallet. Say, I don't trust the way that you handle and sell cymbals, and no matter what you have, I'm not ever going to buy anything from you. I'm pretty far down this rabbit hole where I have had to blacklist certain dealers, and that I think it's the strongest thing you can do is speak with your wallet. You know, hey, I don't like the way you're doing business or the way that you handle this transaction, and I'm not going to give you any more of my money. I think that's that's the right you have as a consumer.
Sure.
But you'll know if you run into an issue. It's usually you bought something and it's not as described, and that's a really common issue. It's also common, very easy to solve now, like with PayPal. Even if you bought something from a drum shop and you got it and it is cracked, and let's say that you paid through your credit card, call your credit card and say, hey, this person sold me something and when I got it, it was cracked. So I want my money back. And maybe, and obviously always give the dealer or the seller a chance to make it right. But if they're being a stick in the mud and they're saying, well, you know, that's tough luck, then not only can you never do business with them again, but call your credit card company or PayPal. Never pay for something with friends and family, PayPal. Always pay for goods and services. That's good advice.
You pay a little bit more. It's like 3% or whatever, which on a, you know, $600 or whatever symbol, that actually does end up being a sort of substantial amount of money of like extra that you're paying. But you'd be amazed what you can get, what's covered with that. So yes, great actionable advice right there.
Yeah, and that's just, I mean, you could do that as like a, that could be the end result that you take away from all of the source considerations. If you don't trust the source, then don't do business with them, because this stuff is not rare, especially if you're putting together a 60s, 70s set of cymbals. You know, you want an 18, 20, and a 22, and a pair of 14-inch hi-hats. You have, it's a buyer's market because there's tons of this stuff. So when you're shopping, factor that all in and don't do business with people that you don't trust. That's also why I like doing business in person with cash, because it's very easy. I'm here. I am interested in the symbol. Here's your price. Here's what I would like to pay. It's, you can almost always close that gap. So let's say you have that 28-inch trans stamp symbol that I'm super interested in, but you want $3,000 for it. Well, I'm here and I have $1,000 in cash. So
money talks.
Do you want it? You know, usually.
Yeah, sure.
I have bought some crazy cymbals for some really good prices because I had cash and the people were motivated sellers. So I think this is a good spot to wrap it up, because we've gone through the timeline. Here's, you know, this is all stuff that you can figure out on your own. But when you are on this journey and you decide you want to play vintage items, here's the considerations, and good luck and have fun on your journey, because I've had a lot of fun. And now I'm in the stage where I get to sit down and play these cymbals and just be really inspired by the instruments. I have nothing against modern cymbals. I actually own modern-ish Turkish cymbals that I play, that I play in a band with. And I don't use my old Zildjians. But when I sit down at my main set, you know, my Camcos, and I put up a set of matching trans stamps, you know, that sound is the payoff. That's the end result of all of these things we're talking about. You know,
you have done such a good job, again, as a pretty young guy, of like really being very knowledgeable. And it's no joke where we go to the drum shows and you pick something up and you know about it and you look at it, but you're also just like very approachable about this whole thing. So if anyone is at the Chicago show, which I don't know if you're going to be there this year, I guess you're still figuring that out. Not this year, but
I'm on the fence. I had to pick Covington or Chicago, and I picked Covington. I might still go to the Chicago show, but as a person who is 90% completed this journey, I no longer suffer from that FOMO. I don't worry that 28-inch symbol is going to be there, because what's going to happen is a dealer is going to scoop it up and I'll see it online in a week, and then I can still get that symbol without having to ever leave my house. So not that that would be, I mean, obviously you love to have a great story and you find it from the original owner's grandson and you get a great price, but that's not exactly realistic, especially at a show as big as Chicago. If you're going to go to the Delaware show or the Pennsylvania show and shop, you're much more likely to find a really great deal because there's fewer dealers there. But when there's 30 to 50 dealers in a room, now it's pretty unlikely that you're going to find a slam dunk deal. You're probably going to have to buy it from one of the dealers, and you're probably going to have to pay, you know, a higher price. But that's all part of it. The ecosystem and how it exists and how you function in that ecosystem is totally up to you as a buyer. And that would be my closing advice, is just to make sure that you are true to yourself and your goals and your budget, you know, because it's going to look different for everybody. The symbols that I have ended up with that I really love are going to be totally different from the symbols that someone else. And that's why it's really cool to see people like my buddy Luke Kondrich, who's on a similar journey. You know, he wants old symbols. I think you probably met Luke.
I did, Luke. We've been emailing about, he's going to do, he and his boss at their company are going to do an episode about history of drumhead art, not painted drumheads. That's a different thing, but like, you know, the sure. decal, like GK and BR and fast forwarding.
That's awesome. Yeah. Luke's a great guy. I met him in 2019 when he was, you know, barely 20 years old. And it's just cool because at that same, the 2009 Covington show where I met Luke, I picked up a 24 inch block stamp A, and that became the first 24 that I had that I kept, because I'd had plenty of other 24s I had picked up and they weren't right. But that one, that was the first symbol where I hit it and everything started to make sense. Wow, this is exactly what I want. Now I want the 26. And now I have, well, I don't want to get too much into what I have, yeah. but I have everything I want. I have a 24, I have a 25, I have a 26. I have wow. you know, several 26s, several 24s. Mm. So that to me is really fun because now I can put together sets. So 26, 25, 24, 16-inch hi-hats. I'm pretty happy with that setup. But, you know, a different person is going to look for something completely different. So,
yeah, I love, it's a whole nother topic, but I do love the idea of putting together sets and the fun of that and making things that work. You know, you've got your set of vintage, whatever, A's, or your set of vintage, you know, trans stamp, or you've got all, you can put together different pieces or even more modern, like, you know, you have a set of A customs or something like that. It's fun sure. to have that grouping of symbols, but awesome, Vincent. Well, this is great. So everyone listening, Vincent is kind enough to hang around. Actually, we're going to record it at a later date, but we're going to do it, a bonus episode on Patreon, which we're going to talk about Vincent's personal symbol journey of kind of the things he has. And I'll mention my symbol journey as well, which is not really as impressive as Vincent's because he's clearly knows his stuff, but I've collected symbols over the years. And then also we're going to talk about knockoffs that you hear about, your Zilkos, your Allegins, your Zenogen, all of your gins that aren't Zildjian.
Yeah.
So we'll do that and we'll record it at a later date to make sure that we have time, because this is great, but it went a little longer than we were hoping originally. So thank you again to Gabriel Martinez and GM Designs for sponsoring the show on Patreon and all that good stuff. I will say the bonus episode idea in general was Vincent's idea. That was your idea. So thank you very much for that. It's been, mm-hmm. you know, why people signed up for Patreon. So, yeah, buddy, thank you for being here, Vincent. I appreciate it, man.
You're very welcome. I think the Patreon is well worth the money. I mean, you get extra episodes. It's not like you're just getting a shirt or a sticker. I mean, you can get a shirt or a sticker or a shout out like Gabriel. Thank you, Gabriel, for doing that. Yeah, Patreon is well worth it. The tier start at $2, and it's pretty much just a no-brainer. If you are absorbing this content, it's a great way to support the podcast. I do want to mention, because I didn't come around to this, but Mike Layton, who passed last year tragically, yeah. he was the guy who really got me into this. At the 2000, geez, it must have been 17 or 18 show, he started coming to these shows, and boy, was he a wealth of knowledge. His knowledge still exists in archive format through Drum Forum. So you can go on there, and if you see M. Layton talking about, he knew a lot of stuff, but he knew a lot about Zildjians. He probably knew more about Zildjians than anyone I've ever met. And obviously, a lot of people know a lot of things, but he was the first person I talked to. And it was because I was looking for that 26 to complement my 24, and he had three of them. There was only three in the whole room, and he had all three. Maybe he bought them at the wow. show, but I mean, he was just a wealth of knowledge, and seeing the way that he collected, talking to him, interacting with him, it was such a privilege. So rest in peace to Mike, and thank you, Mike, yeah. for really helping me along in this journey. Always share your information. Don't hold things close. Don't keep secrets. If you find people who are interested in the same thing, and also don't hoard your symbols. I'm not really one to talk with that, but I am going to let go a lot of my symbols in the next couple of years.
Sure.
But Mike really epitomized that, not only really being just super knowledgeable about it, but also having an amazing ear. And then, of course, sharing that knowledge with further generations. You know, it's very important. Yeah.
That is nice. And I know he meant a lot to you, and probably a lot to the people who listen to this who are longtime collectors. And it's an unfortunate thing, but this podcast, it's been around for 4.5 years now. It has become a platform for, there's some people who have been spoken about on the podcast or who have been on the show who aren't around anymore. So again, it's nice to thank and remember those people. So I appreciate you doing that. So again, Vincent, you're a real buddy in the community and you're a pillar of the drum community. And I think everyone enjoys seeing you at the shows and enjoys what you've said today to learn more about Zildjian cymbals. And we will have you back on for more pedal stuff down the road and another episode, I'm sure. So for now, Vincent, thank you for being here, my friend.
Thanks so much, Bart. I really appreciate it.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.